And we're live on the Heritage Radio Network. This is the Q Report. I'm Katie Kiefer.
I'm Patrick Martins. Q stands for quotidian, the everyday fabric of our lives, covering interesting nuances, interesting things that might not get covered in other shows.
That's right. Like, for instance,
barbecue.
Exactly.
Which is really, I cannot wait to talk about barbecue. I mean, it's a true Southern tradition. Or I don't know if it is. We'll ask Scott.
It's a true American tradition. And Scott is going to be able to tell us, I think, the origins, the different traditions, the different regions in our country that produce barbecue and swear that theirs is the only right one.
We also have Hal Cragen on, who's a musician and a producer. He lives appropriately in Woodstock, and he's performed with a bunch of bands like They Might Be Giants.
Wow.
And he just produced Iggy Pop's new CD.
What? Iggy Pop? I didn't even know he was still alive.
Yeah, he's still like got a six-pack and stuff. He still doesn't wear a shirt wherever he goes.
Does he wear a codpiece?
He still does. And then we also have an obituary section today.
That's right, Army Archer.
Army Archer, one of the nice, I mean, he was an official greeter at the Academy Awards for 47 years, but he was one of the true last of the Mohicans for nice journalism.
Yeah.
You know, he was a real
nice
guy.
For standing up for the right thing.
Yeah, and not pandering towards, you know, this alarmist, kind of, nothing like that with his stuff. It was more, you know, just general positive things.
About the entertainment industry.
About the entertainment industries, of course.
Yeah.
So, before we get to our show, we always do a little introduction. And, of course, you know, this is September 11th was just a couple of days ago. And I actually heard all the names. I was listening.
I listened to the names, too.
My banker, my original banker, who gave Heritage Foods its first line of credit at HSBC Bank, even though we probably didn't fit the bill exactly for a business that deserved it. His son passed away, so I was listening to for the O'Connor part of that, and it was actually, of course, I listened to all of them from A to Z, but very, very sad. Even after all these 8 years, like, you couldn't help but be brought to tears with some of these people and what they said.
I can't believe that it's been 8 years. To me, it seems like it really was only a year or two ago. I was glad that it rained, because I've always felt since then that those incredibly beautiful blue sky days are kind of ruined for me in a funny way. Like, a few days before September 11th, or right around the first week of September, we had a string of those really perfect days. And I was visiting with a friend of mine in Rhode Island, and I said, "Oh, it's a September 11th day." And she looked at me like I was crazy. It was like, why would you associate something so terrible with something so beautiful? Mm-hmm. Because I can never think of it any other way.
And you know, there's a lot of these young hipsters that are like, "Oh my God, it's all the September 11th again." And yet, you know, man, if something happened to a loved one of mine, you know, I would want to follow that mantra of, like, we will never forget.
I will never forget. Anyone who lived in New York at that time will never forget, whether you had a friend or a relative who perished in the attacks, or whether you were just part of the whole intense period of mourning and fear that we all went through for the days and weeks after, as the smoke kept on drifting up to the sky, and as you kept on smelling those burning chemicals and those burning building materials for weeks and weeks afterwards. I live on the Upper West Side. I mean, we could see that, and those beautiful lights that they shone up into the sky for months afterwards. It was really one of the most intense experiences anyone can go through without actually having been, you know, personally injured at the time.
Yeah, it was the largest attack on American soil in history, right? So,
yeah.
And well, maybe in
produced a psychic wound in the city. I felt like the city was itself a living organism that had sustained a tremendous and mortal blow.
And actually very unified, you know?
Oh, I mean, yeah.
People were very nice to each other. No one was really honking their horns as much. And, you know, it did last for a while and still lives on. I mean,
I think so. I think New Yorkers, in a funny way, really benefited from the experience in the sense of feeling that we are all together, regardless of where we came from originally. Mm-hmm. We all came together to New York City, and this is our home, and we should treasure it and value it.
And a newfound respect, even though this respect's always been there, for the members of the New York City Fire Department and police, you know, who just ran up those
stairs. Right.
I mean, that's their job. And I think it was a real humbling moment, you know, for New Yorkers to realize what these people
to really recognize what they do on a daily basis.
That's day in and day out.
It's heroism daily. It's not just for the special occasion.
Well, on that note, no, we will take a break.
I'll have to take a break now because now I'm in tears.
A little bit of a break, and we will come back with Scott, the pitmaster at Rub BBQ on West 23rd Street. Well, we are very excited to be back at the Q Report. I'm Patrick Martins.
I'm Katie Kiefer. This is the Heritage Radio Network, and
we were brought to you by Sam Edwards.
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by Edwards of Surrey, Virginia. www.edwardsvaham.com. You're listening to...
You should be looking for their Suriano ham, because this is the first American version of prosciutto that I think really lives up to the tradition of prosciutto di Parma. It's just fantastic.
And all these people that are like, eat local.
Yeah.
Wah, wah. And then here they go and buy prosciutto,
di Parma.
You know, which is A, very far away, but still very good. I don't have a problem with that. But B, that terroir is overtaxed. The entire world is looking to that little region to provide all the prosciutto all over the world, and it's not correct. So it's very important to develop new terroirs, new traditions,
sure.
And Sam Edwards has effectively done it thanks to the high-quality pork products of Newman Farm, as well as, you know, a bunch of others in the Midwest. So
indeed.
Very good stuff. Well, I am very excited. I was never a big barbecue fan. You know, it was always very saucy until I found Rub Barbecue, which is right under Serena's house. And she's the bookkeeper, kind of chief financial officer for Heritage Foods. So I've been there quite a lot. And man, I love that place. And here we are with Scott Smith, the pit master.
How you doing?
How's it going?
Pretty good.
Scott, do you actually have a pit there?
We have four of them.
It's a true pit barbecue?
Well, it's a smoker. What we have to use in the city isn't a traditional outside offset, a smoker with an offset firebox. You can't really use that in the city because we're not allowed to burn full logs, and they have a lot of, you know, the fire department's kind of leery about that. So we actually have machines that are made to be, they're basically like a convection oven mm-hmm. with a firebox. There's no gas. It's all electric, which is actually key in the long cooking process.
In the slow cooking.
Yeah.
Really good barbecue has to be really slow cooked, right?
Definitely. And all of our flavor just, you know, it just comes from, you know, there's real burning wood. I mean, we have burning, we just can't burn full logs. We do have burning wood in our smokers.
So you have chips in the smokers.
Well, we have it's a cut down piece of wood. It's not quite a chip. Uh-huh. A chip to really produce real barbecue, you have to actually combust wood. Hmm. When you're just smoldering it, you're not going to get the same chemical reactions in the meat with the smoke and everything like that as when you're actually combusting the wood.
Uh huh. So what do you mean by the chemical reactions? What does that impart?
Well, there's certain reactions with the nitrates and the smoke and the bacteria in the meat that become... when you get real, really smoked barbecue, you'll notice that there's a pink ring along the outside of the meat. A lot of people mistake that for undercooked, but it's kind of funny that the pink is on the outside and the cooked stuff's on the inside. But with the pink ring is actually very similar to like what happens when you make ham or corned beef. It's actually like it's almost like corned or cured by the smoke. There's actually nitrates in the smoke that do that, and they only really are released when the wood is combusting and not just smoldering.
I see.
Well, tell us about some of the tools that you use. I mean, obviously, like with any kitchen, barbecue probably needs, you know, very heavily reliant on the tools that you use, and they're probably different than most regular kitchens.
For the most part, it's pretty... I mean, the smoker's the biggest thing.
And what smokers do you have?
We actually have J&R Pitts from Texas.
Okay.
I believe it's Mesquite, Texas. I might be wrong in that. I haven't talked to them in a while. But they are actually from Texas, and they're fantastic.
Is that the style of barbecue that your restaurant does?
Because
I know
all.
There's Kansas City barbecue, mm-hmm. and there's Carolina barbecue.
We actually do what we call championship barbecue. So that way we have no regional
constraints.
Yeah, exactly. That way we
just like New York itself.
Exactly, that's right. Yeah. You're bringing it all together in the great big melting pot of rub barbecue.
Yep. And that way we can escape like anybody saying, well, I'm from North Carolina and this pork isn't vinegary enough for me, or I'm from Texas and I want this, you know, I expect this. And people still do that, but we can kind of like step away from and say, well, look, we're not a Texas barbecue or a Carolina barbecue. We do competition style, which is the best of everything.
Now, right, tell us about this tool, this cooker, this J&R,
yes.
J&R cooker. Like, how is that different? Like, what do they offer? Like, what is the range, the spectrum of possible cookers? I know anytime a restaurant opened, like Blue Smoke
mm-hmm.
or a barbecue restaurant, they're like, this is the type of oven we use, or, you know.
I don't want to bash other barbecues or anything like that, but there are... the biggest difference with J&R is the fact that it's electric and not gas. Gas, natural gas and propane both have an additive to it to make it smell called mercaptan.
It makes it smell stinky, right?
Exactly. So,
so you notice.
Exactly. Normally natural gas and propane have no odor.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to add this mercaptan so you can smell it. Mm-hmm. Well, when you're grilling, it's no problem because you only got your meat on there for like 10 minutes, half an hour at the most.
Right.
But when you're actually smoking for upwards of 12 hours or even probably upwards of 6 hours, the mercaptan works its way in the meat and you can actually taste it. And it's kind of imparts of a weird, you know, flavor to it. Yeah, I mean, so we avoid that by having the J&R. That's one of the benefits of the J&R smokers.
Is that it's electric, so it's not put off gassing anything.
Exactly. And the electric, uh-huh. the only thing that's really electric about it is basically that it's a convection oven.
Mm-hmm.
So the electricity spins the impeller blade to move the air around inside the smoker,
right.
And there's also a slight electrical assist as far as the heat. And when you're cooking as low, you know, around 225 to 250 degrees, you don't need that much of an electric assist. So, I mean, a lot of it's coming from the wood anyway. But
describe to us that low. I mean, everyone has heard slow and low mm-hmm. and long cooking times, but what is really happening? Almost from like a biological way, you know, with the meat, like what does that truly do versus like a high heat, you know, cook it real quick?
When you cook, so I mean, the cuts that you want to cook slow for a long time are the fattier cuts with a lot of connective tissue and a lot of like to me, like the good stuff inside a piece of meat. You know, you got the like the collagen and all these great things that break down over long cooking times and make this like really nice, like tender, juicy meat. If you were to take something like a brisket and try to cook it quick, You'll cook it all the way through, and it'll be completely cooked, but it'll be the meat will be tough and tight. Yeah, exactly.
Because what happens when you cook it quick, it just doesn't have enough time to really break down?
Yeah, exactly. It's just kind of like you're cooking it through, but the meat's not actually just like kind of breaking down slowly. I mean, I don't know the exact like chemical processes or physical processes that are happening in the meat itself, but I can tell. I mean, you can just tell the difference when you're eating it. I mean, as they say, the proof's in the pudding. It's just so tough. And then in the opposite, if you were to take like a fillet and try to slow smoke it, it'd be disgusting because it would be dry and
Has no fat.
Exactly,
collagen or connective tissue.
Like a fillet mignon.
Oh. Yeah, because it's just iron. One really well. A flat iron, I think, has a lot more fat to it.
That'd be a little bit better.
A fillet is just one muscle.
Yeah. Don't work for barbecue. What are some cuts you would never see in barbecue besides the filet mignon?
Pretty much all the steak cuts. Anything you see served as a steak. Yeah, right. Ribeye. I mean, you can
none of the middle meats. Well, you go can do into barbecue.
Ribeye is a funny one though, because you can do a ribeye like a prime rib, and it comes out fantastic.
Is that right?
Oh yeah,
I've never seen that on the menu.
Oh, it's there's another restaurant in New York that serves it. They're based Hill Country, which is based on.
Oh yeah, they're supposed to be great.
Mm-hmm. They do a Texas Hill Country style barbecue, and some of the restaurants in the Texas Hill Country actually do prime rib.
Expensive cut of meat to cook that way, though. So
yes,
I mean, how do you make that profitable in the context of a restaurant?
You just got to charge more.
Yeah,
I mean, they do.
That's sort of antithetical to the barbecue tradition, isn't barbecue supposed to be kind of cheap?
It is, but I mean, in Manhattan, it's kind of hard because no matter how cheap your meat is, your rent's still high and everything else still high. That's right.
Why should barbecue? If anything, it should be more expensive because of the amount of time it takes
and
to
the
go
energy.
In.
Yeah. Yeah, right. It's true.
Well, I mean, you know, in the classic restaurant setup, you're not really you don't really charge for time so much. You know, it's kind of just assumed, I guess. And in the South, it is cheap. I mean, in and outside of New York, it's fairly inexpensive. You know, but
definitely.
In Manhattan, you still got to pay the rent.
Rub is not very expensive. I mean, to be fair, I mean, you're saying it's a little bit more expensive than traditional barbecue, but you could have a great meal there for $15.
Oh, completely. I mean, if you're coming from the South and are, you know, used to having the prices of a Southern barbecue, there's going to be a lot. And there is. I mean, we get a lot of Southerners that come in like, I can't pay that. I'm not going to pay this much for a barbecue sandwich. It's only $3. Where I'm from, it's like, well, where you're from, they pay about probably a quarter of what we pay in rent, and if not less, you know? It's just...
And plus, you support very sustainable producers like Heritage Foods and others.
Yeah, we try to do that as much as possible. I love to do it as much as possible.
Where is your restaurant located, by the way?
23rd between 7th and 8th in Chelsea.
Oh.
Yeah, it's a...
That's right in my neighborhood. Well, not really, but I'm a West Sider, so it's not hard for me to get down there.
Us about the Southern traditions. I mean, the Southern roots of this. I mean, is this a Southern cooking tradition? And like, where did you go to visit and learn the trade?
How'd you learn how to be a pit master?
How did I learn? Trial and error. Well, I grew up in upstate New York where we really don't have, well, now they're starting to have it, but before we really didn't have barbecue. Well,
did you grow up in?
I grew up in Trumansburg, which is outside of Ithaca.
We're actually going to spend some time talking about upstate in the final segment that's where you're from, and it's really
interesting. And it's got a real hot ag thing happening up
now.
Wow, really cool. Some great producers.
Yeah, do miss it. I moved here probably 4.5 years ago, 5 years ago. And when I moved here, it was just starting to. I mean, they were doing a lot up there then, and now it's even better. I mean, I go back now and I'm jealous that I'm still not working up there in a restaurant, just because the availability of great produce and everything is so much. It's just amazing. But
tell us about where did you go? Did you travel the country?
Well, my first exposure to barbecue was a roadside stand up there that some college professors did for a couple summers before they decided that catering was much more profitable and stopped doing the roadside thing. And then so I had a couple year lull. And then a few years later, I joined the Army and got stationed in Savannah, Georgia. And so there was a little bit of barbecue in Savannah.
What unit were you in?
I was in the 1st Ranger Battalion.
1st Ranger Battalion?
Yeah, it's 1st of the 75th. It's based out of Hunter Arm Airfield, and right in the middle of the city of Savannah. I couldn't ask for a better place to get stationed. It's you can walk to downtown Savannah. You can walk to pretty much wherever you need to go in Savannah. and it was a fantastic place. But because it was a smaller unit and a special operations unit, we had a little more better funding. So instead of driving around in the big 5-ton trucks like most Army units do, we used to travel in 15-passenger vans, so we had a little more flexibility when it came to food. And so we'd try to, like, you know, I'd always try to push to stop at, like, these roadside barbecues all over the South. We'd go over to, we were in Alabama, South Carolina, North Carolina.
And the guys were like, we want Burger King.
No, I mean, well, you know, I could be persuasive when it came to food. You know, I was like, they knew, you know, I had some kind of a, you know, pretty good food background. So when I was like, oh, we should check this out, they kind of, you know, would listen to me. So I got to check out quite a bit of barbecue that way. And then when I moved back up to the Ithaca area, I just kind of fell into it. I had a friend of mine that wanted to open a roadside barbecue stand, and so I kind of said, well, what the heck, I'll try it. You know, I was a chef at the time, and had just gotten laid off from the restaurant I was working at, so it just kind of, like, worked out perfectly, and we started out as a roadside barbecue. We had, I think we started with a smoke. He had a smoker because he just retired from the fire department, so he had, like, a little, it was a toy, but it was a big toy. It was a full-size trailer smoker, and we started with that smoker, two tables. We had a picnic table for people to eat at and a table for us to work at, a tent, and like $1,000. And then we just kind of grew it from there.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was, and that was a whole learning process. I mean, I'd eaten a lot of barbecue, but I hadn't really, I mean, I can't, and I understood the basics of it, but I had to, like, refine actually cooking. And it probably took me a couple weeks to where I was really starting to put out, you know, really decent barbecue. But then after that, it kind of, like, you know, I got the hang of it.
Okay, let's talk about putting out decent barbecues. So part of the learning curve in barbecue, it seems to me, is how to actually make the meat as juicy and pull apart, mm-hmm. fall apart, delicious as it is. But the other part of it is the different kinds of sauces that you baste with or that you serve it with at the end. So let's talk a little bit about
Is dry rub part of that?
There's dry mops, and there's dry vinegar rubs, and there's wet mops, based. And there's, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So
there's a lot there. I mean,
there's a lot there.
It could be
very,
I mean,
regional.
And even inside each regional, inside of each individual regional, it's even different, like from town to town almost. It's really almost baffling. I mean, you can go from, let's say, Texas, where it's a very simple, you know, salt and pepper, put it in the smoker. They serve it to you with some crackers and some, you know, maybe some pickled jalapenos or raw jalapenos. Hot sauce at the most, no sauce at all. You go to the Carolinas, the Carolinas itself is really varied all over each state. I mean, North Carolina, there's two different regions. There's Eastern and Western. Eastern, right. Being that they both Eastern and Western generally do pork shoulder.
Yeah, they do that pulled pork.
Mm-hmm, exactly, and that's usually with a shoulder. A few places, I think less and less all the time, are doing whole hog, and I don't think there's very many left in the Carolinas.
Hog picking, yeah. Where they just pick it off.
Exactly. Well, they'll do, instead of doing like a particular cut, like what we'll do for our pulled pork is we use a pork shoulder, which is like the exact optimum cut of pork to make pulled pork.
What do you use, Boston butt or picnic?
Boston butt. Bone, okay. In Boston butt. Picnic's great.
It's not so fatty, right?
Well, what's the difference between the bone-in Boston butt and the picnic?
The picnic.
It's a different part of the muscle.
Well, no,
the lower part is the picnic. Higher part is the Boston butt.
Well, it also has the. I believe the picnic also has the skin and the foreshank or the shank part of the shank still on it, uh-huh. Or the front leg, and so it makes a fantastic pulled pork, but it takes like probably 5 to 6 hours longer to cook it,
uh-huh.
and you're running into a you know, cost benefit situations. Like,
definitely.
If I, you know, do I spend the extra 6 hours and space too? I mean, you get that leg sticking out, it takes up more room in the smoker. So in the Carolina, in North Carolina, both sides are, you know, Eastern and Western are both doing the Boston or the pork butts generally, and then in the Eastern part, their sauce is just basically cider vinegar, salt, pepper, sugar, red pepper flakes, maybe right. A little variation on that. And in the Eastern part, you end up with a sauce that's similar, but they have a ketchup in it or some
it
kind of
tomato.
It has
a tomato base.
Exactly.
Yeah, I've made that.
Mm-hmm.
The one that the recipe I have, which I don't, my mother gave me, mm-hmm. but it has a lot of, it has cinnamon in it and mustard and.
That's a very involved one. That's a good one.
It's quite involved. It's excellent. That, cloves.
Yeah.
I mean, and you simmer the sauce for like an hour, and then you, at first you boil the shoulder, and then you bake it with the sauce, and then you.
No, just kidding. <Yeah. laughs>
And then you pull it apart and bake it with the sauce uh-huh. in it again, so that the sauce really permeates basically every cell of the meat. I mean, my mouth is literally watering.
I can imagine.
About this. It's awfully good.
That sauce sounds much better than what they actually serve in Western North Carolina. From one of my experiences, what I had, it was very simple, very not super flavorful, but it carried the. It was a, you know, it helped the pork out. It kind of like, you know, picked it up a little bit. It was good, and then and then even in the Western, they actually do this. This slaw, this crazy slaw they put on the sandwich, it's like a ketchup-based slaw. You know, we have mustard,
Now that's
mayonnaise.
Where you need to run that sound effect, Patrick.
It's like
Yuck.
This red, it's interesting, you know? Yeah. It's
Coleslaw with Russian dressing, is that what you're talking about?
No, there's no even mayonnaise in it. It's just
it's ketchup
red, like
and
ketchup.
Vinegar?
Yeah.
Oh, baby.
Yeah, and chop fine like the KFC style there.
Yeah.
So it makes for an interesting sandwich topping.
Really?
Well, and now, been to KFC. Is your menu constantly changing? Are you constantly trying new things? Or is it, we were just talking to Gina earlier on a previous show, and she was like, you know, what she loves about cooking is doing the same thing over and over year after
and
year.
Executing it perfectly.
Making it perfect. Or how much freedom does barbecue give you to experiment with new things or cooking techniques?
Well, I don't get, the thing with barbecue is, you're not, as far as cooking techniques, you're not really doing too much different. I mean, the big difference is in the cuts. You can try different new cuts, this and that, maybe different rubs. We tend not to get away from our normal sauce, so I'm not trying like different sauces and stuff like that. Since we've opened, I think one or two new sauces, but those were, I think we introduced a spicier version of our normal sauce. And then we did a Carolina style sauce, but I've tried several different cuts, this and that. I've actually, it's tough. I mean, with our restaurant, it's tough to do different things because people come in for specific. They come in. I want the burn ins.
It's a real institution.
Yeah,
I think that's true of any successful restaurant, though. I mean, that's what Gina was saying about Babbo. It's like you can't mess with what works.
Yeah, that's.
You know, if you want to stay successful, you have to kind of stick with your program.
And there is, I mean, for me, and it's funny that you should say that she loves doing the same thing over, and which I completely appreciate and love that. But it's same, for me, it's the it's almost a little frustrating because I like to try to. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love cooking, so it's like always like I love to try new things, do this and that, and it's just.
Well, you have specials on the menu.
Oh
right?
Yeah, and I mean, it's not like I can't do stuff on my own, right? So I keep that, and I do love doing. I do love doing barbecue. I love trying to make the perfect thing the perfect meat every day, and I do that, and there's a lot of satisfaction in that, but at the same time, I do like a little variation, so it's
So barbecue is really the only two meats that are typically used in barbecue are beef or pork.
No, we do.
Or do you use other meats?
Do chicken, lamb. I've actually this past year, I had a great experience this past year working with the people from Owensboro, Kentucky. Actually, specifically the Moonlight, which do mutton. They do.
Cool.
It's fantastic too.
Really?
It's
mutton.
Yeah. It actually
that's old lamb over a year old.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah. Exactly.
It's a mature sheep.
And
yeah.
And I never had much experience with it, but I was working
it's
very
with the strongly flavored meat.
Yes, and it does great with barbecue. The flavor of smoke and that strong strong gaminess of the mutton go together beautifully.
No kidding.
Yeah.
See, I don't think I would never have guessed that. So here we've learned something new, and I'm sure other people are going to want to try that later on this season.
I learned a lot with that this summer. I mean, it was a whole new experience for me. I worked with the Food and Film Festival, and they do the New York Food and Film Festival with George Motes and Harry Hawk. And what they'll do is
we should get George Motes on sometime too.
Yeah. Right, not Harry Hawk.
Well, Harry too, but George Motes did that whole film on hamburger. I have a whole thing that I want to do about hamburger, and we're going to talk about that in just a second. Oh my God, we're almost out of time, Scott.
No, we have like five or six minutes,
but we wanted to talk about upstate New York, and
let's just go to upstate New York. It's so fascinating. Yeah. Where are you from? How old were you? You know, tell us about the town. Tell us about the industry. Give us a little bit of sense of where you're from.
Well, I grew up in a town called Trumansburg, New York.
Trumansburg
is a very, obviously, I'm a little partial, and I have my own views because I grew up there. So I can't really say for, but to me, it's a very interesting town. It's got its own kind of it's a weird mix of old hippies and farmers, and it makes for a great place to grow up. I mean,
are your parents old hippies?
Or They're not old hippies or farmers. I couldn't, you know, it's probably the only two
people. Can't explain why they're there.
They're not old, they're not hippies, and they're not
and they're
farmers.
Well, farmers.
They're getting a little older, but and they're not listening, so I can say that. But,
they don't have my internet.
No, they're but they it's a great town. It's we've had some that's where, I don't know if any of you guys have heard of the Finger Lakes Grassroots Festival.
Mm-mm.
And it's a great music festival that happens up there. And that's actually in Trumansburg. The Rongovian Embassy was in Trumansburg. Hmm. The synthesizer was invented in
Trumansburg. The Rongovian Embassy?
Yep.
And tell us what that is.
The Rongovian
there
Embassy.
There is not a country called Rongovia.
No, well, there.
That sounds like some place from Austin Powers where Dr. Evil was from.
The Rongovian Embassy was a famous bar in the 70s. Oh. It was a great place for live music. It's still open. It's not in the same kind of... It's not quite doing as good as it was in the 70s. But there's still
it will now after this radio plug.
I hope so.
Yeah, it's going to blow up.
That'd be fantastic.
Now, is this the area like around... because I know there's a lot of really great agriculture happening.
That was a little late.
In upstate New York, in the like Cambridge, New York, mm-hmm. Shushan. Are you guys near there? Is that...
That's not quite that close. We're right in the middle. You know where the... are you familiar with the lakes themselves?
No, I've never been to them.
Well, I mean,
I know where
map.
They are, though. Yeah,
Finger
okay,
lakes.
Got that.
There's
yep.
two big ones in the middle.
Yeah, it's a big wine-producing region. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Trumansburg's right between the two big lakes.
I see.
Smack dab in the middle.
How
and
beauty.
It's...
So you grew up going to the lake and boating and mm-hmm. all of that good stuff.
Is it a depressed area there? Economically?
Not at all.
It's
not. At all. No, we're very... it's very... I mean, it's a little slower now, but I mean, it's not that bad. We're very insulated because there's two... really good colleges there. It's Ithaca College and Cornell. So that brings in a lot of
ooh,
a lot
those
of money.
Are big, Ithaca and Cornell.
Very big.
And what's the locals? I mean, do they like New York? I mean, is there a kind of disconnect or feeling of solidarity with New York? Like, is it viewed as the big city in the state?
Not, you know, it's funny. That area between Ithaca, Trumansburg, and a couple of the other small towns, it's kind of like it's almost like a eclectic enclave of people that all would do very well in New York City. I mean, just outside of there, maybe not. But mm-hmm. in that group, and a lot of people that live there are from here or have lived here for a good amount of time. So it's not like it's
and
not
then we're lucky enough to land a tenured professor track at,
exactly.
at Ithaca or Cornell.
Yeah,
wahoo, praise the Lord.
It's an interesting place to live.
I bet. It sounds fascinating. I want to go visit.
And is that where you met your girlfriend who also works at Red Barbecue, or is she your wife?
Yes, it is. Not yet. We're actually engaged to be married in about a year.
Sweet. Are you going to go married up there?
Yes. Actually, we just found the location this past summer. I think we're going to be getting married at. So hopefully it's ready for us by the time we're...
And you're going to raise a little pack of tiny little pit masters and mistresses?
Yes, probably, yes, hopefully.
free labor.
Exactly.
Love that. Yeah, really, man. Train them up young.
Definitely. Get them to load the pits early.
Yeah.
Keep the fire burning, chopping the wood.
Well, we always like to do this last thing just for the young pit masters out there who are wondering, you know, do I want to get into barbecue? What skill sets do you think are necessary for a successful barbecue pit master?
Well, a strong back doesn't hurt. You got to do it. It's a lot of lifting, a lot of physical labor. A lot of it's patience. I mean,
you need good patience, right?
What's the average time in the smoker for, say, a whole brisket, second cut? That's what, about
20 hours?
10 pounds?
About 20. Well, 16 hours. We'll say for the flat, 14, 16 hours, 20 hours for the deckel to get done. Because what we'll do is what we do at the restaurant,
you split them.
The whole thing mm-hmm. until the flat's done. And then separate them, and then we put the deckel back in, and that becomes burnt ends, which are fantastic. It's probably the best thing we have on the menu.
But you lose. Sometimes you're out of that though, because like people love them so much.
Well, the one thing that I wish I could get out there to everybody is, because people do get frustrated when we run out of burnt ends, but you cannot have burnt ends without selling brisket. You got to sell that brisket to get the burnt end. So if you're not selling briskets.
So you idiots out there, order the brisket sandwich and the burnt ends.
Exactly. So that way everybody can have burnt ends.
I love that. I always said I grew up in coffee shops, basically, in Manhattan. You know, that's where I would go. And my mom and I always knew you asked for them to burn the French fries
mm-hmm.
to make them super well done. So it's nice that the barbecue society has, like, embraced the word burnt, which doesn't sound like it should be good, but it is.
They're fantastic.
Well, burnt meat on a stick. There's nothing better than that when you're chopping the local food carts. I mean, what do you want? You want burnt meat on a stick. Yeah.
We love it. We need a burnt end sound effect. That would be cool. I don't know how to do that, but we are engineered today by Nat Wiener.
Nat Wiener. And our producer is Jack Inslee.
Right. Engineered by Nat Wiener, who's also known as Rec Tech, produced by Jack Inslee, who, by the way, added beautiful new bios and show descriptions on the program page of Heritage Radio Network.
Thank you very much, Jack.
.com.
You're so, a wonderful person.
Very, very good. And he did that with Nat Wiener, really did
Nat
most of the writing.
Nat is also an incredibly wonderful person.
Nat's like, I'm done for the month.
Nat's just a lot more quiet.
Anyway, well, this has been very interesting. I mean, barbecue is truly American. You can go
really get into the nitty gritty of tradition started.
But I think Scott maybe liked this place enough, and could come back again.
Maybe
hopefully.
We can persuade you.
Oh, yeah? I don't think it wouldn't be very hard at all to get me back out here.
That's great to
beautiful,
hear.
Beautiful, yeah.
That's great. And barbecue, it's truly American. You go around the world, and even in the most snooty Italian or French, culinary worlds, they will admit that barbecue and treating meat like that is a very American tradition.
It's peculiarly American, even though other countries, the Chinese have a barbecue tradition. But there is something about that slow cooking with the smoke.
I found most cultures do have a barbecue tradition. Mm-hmm. It's not like ours exactly, not exactly like ours, but there's similarities. A lot of like if you look at the even in South America, these guys are. In Argentina. Well, there's barbecoa, but also in
they
Argentina.
They have the carne asado where they... Oh, no, that's... sorry, that's a bit roasted. Excuse me.
Well, they do this great thing where they take like a whole animal and split it up, butterfly it. Like a whole steer and whole goats, and they butterfly it on this Y-shaped stick, and they have it leaning in over this fire. And they just kind of rotate it over.
You know, I saw that in a street fair in Manhattan not long ago, about a year ago.
Well, a whole animal?
The guy had he had a big piece of meat, and he had it on that triangular-shaped frame. Yeah. And he was
hachi-machi.
I'm telling
you. That's beautiful, yeah.
I think he said he was from Argentina. I was very intrigued by that.
Yeah. The more I've looked around as far as reach, not so much, I've kind of like, looked into it out of curiosity, nothing serious, but just kind of, there's some great stuff going on around the world as far as like slow cooking with wood and burning fire, and there's everybody.
Would you use wood if you could?
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that's how you would do it upstate if there was no.
Oh yeah, I mean I use wood here. I mean I used to use wood upstate when I had my restaurant. It's just fantastic. I mean you get the heat and the flavor. I mean and if you don't want so much and you can with wood you can. You can change so there's so many variables with wood. I mean, not with the moisture, the and then like the with the different kinds of wood, you get different flavors, and it's
so
amazing.
Hickory is going to give a different flavor than apple wood.
Definitely.
Like those are the two woods that you usually see associated with barbecue is like hickory smoked or apple wood smoked.
Yeah, they're completely
like
different.
Like when they cure bacon, you always see that.
Where do you fantastic. Get your wood from? Do you know the source of it like you do your meats?
Yes, actually I do. We get our wood it's fairly local actually. We get our wood from just over in Jersey. There's actually a new law that they instituted in New York State that you're not allowed to take your wood or bring wood or at least in New York City you're not allowed to bring wood from further than 50 miles away.
Really?
Yeah. No kidding.
God, they've enforced the local thing with that. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, well, I think that's more of a disease. Like they don't want weird bugs and stuff coming in from into the city.
Yeah, since we already have
that. That would be good for the local food movement if they could install bugs into the various meats coming in from around the world. They would get their dream.
Unfortunately, I think that's already happening.
We have a sound effect for locavores, which is... E9. This is for the locavores. There's a lot of crying, not so much solution-based. By the way, Obama, one of the things he has been talking about is distribution networks.
Hello,
to help it
my
get
favorite
to
subject.
Finally, someone is seeing the
bigger picture.
Great ideas, everyone. Who is the dude or the girl or the company that's actually going to get that stuff into the schools? I mean, that's the real nitty-gritty
stuff. Yeah, it's not that whether or not you grow the stuff, it's how you transport it from where it's grown to somebody's plate.
And anyone has a good idea is welcome to the table as long as they have implemented that idea or have a concrete... I mean, in a weird way, I think Heritage Foods is like a Republican within the state's sustainable food world, which is like, get it done. Yeah. Like, what is your solution? An idea is not enough. So, very interesting. Anyway, thanks, Scott. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back with Hal Cragen and then an obituary on Army Archer.
Think of barbecue, man. I gotta get me down to Rub. Get me a pulled pork sandwich.
I love Rub and Chelsea. You know, you have a, it's the,
talk about a,
very happy, what's the word I'm
looking
marriage. For? A gay kind of like fun. No, it's funny. No, but you see big old school barbecue. I mean, I have a friend who's has a bunch of great friends and they love Rub barbecue. And it's just interesting to see these like old pitmaster types, you know, meats. You know, the very like liberal New York kind of Chelsea scene. But it's a match made in heaven. I mean, Rub does very, very well.
Who could not love barbecue?
Amongst the good locals barbecue. As well as...
I thought it was cool that Scott had been in the Army too. I liked that. We'll have to expand
hardcore,
on
man.
That.
We could talk hours about everything from food to what it's like being in the Army.
Absolutely. But now...
We have Hal Cragen, who was a guest brought to us mysteriously by Mark. He said, you should put Mark Marabella, who... co-host the Q sometimes.
Yep.
It was like, you got to put Hal. He didn't tell us anything about Hal, but he was like, this guy is absolutely going to make a great guest. So we're very happy to have Hal Cragen on the show.
Well, I hope I can live up to that you know, introduction.
Don't worry. We have sound effects to help out in case you...
And besides, you have a very cute giggle.
You got your 360 systems going, I hope.
Yes, exactly. Well, thanks for being that. You're calling in from Woodstock, are you not?
Woodstock, New York, by way of the East Village, by way of L.A., then back to New York, and not the city this time. So, you know, I keep on living in different coasts.
Well, now you are a musician as well as a record producer, and you performed with some very interesting bands. Tell us a little bit about some of your performing history before we get into some of your production history.
Well, I guess more the most notable, there's been a lot, but Iggy Pop was about 8-year run with him. So, you know, a lot of people, you put that in there and people are, Iggy.
Yeah.
But I play with Sarah McLachlan. I play with They Might Be Giants. I was part of their band and wrote some stuff with them and recorded records and stuff. And they're kind of interesting Brooklyn band for the Brooklyn listeners, even though this Brooklyn band is a lot of them now. And, you know, Eddie Kirkland, who was this kind of blues guy out there. Frank Black, who was the head of the Pixies. I work with Beth Orton, who's kind of an interesting singer-songwriter. And
these are huge names.
Yeah,
Al.
Tell
this
us about.
Like, my jaw's on the floor.
No,
I mean you're rocking. You're royalty here. You're music royalty, right?
Well, you know what? When you're a musician, you feel like, you know, it's just part of your game of playing music. And when you are playing music on a level that everyone is, you know, on top of their game at what they do best.
And you're getting record deals, and the records are actually getting distribution and airplay.
Yeah, back in the day, that was a lot easier. But, it's just kind of like you don't think about it much. You just do it, and it's a nice feeling when you get to actually do something you planned on when you were 13 years old.
Tell us why it was easier back then to get record and airplay. I mean, is that because of a consolidation of the industry, or, you know, how were things different back in the day?
Well, you know, consolidation of the industry, I mean, simply put, that was about as easy as it is, Clear Channel. Radios are cutting their bottom lines, and you know, individual DJ personalities are being supplanted by pre-programmed formats, you know. That's which
right. So there's, you know, four big companies: Infinity, Cox, Clear Channel, and who's the no, I think that's it. Infinity, Cox, and Clear Channel, right?
Yeah.
Those are the really big players in national broadband radio.
And that ends up, there's just not as many regional or local DJs picking the songs that they like, and so there's just fewer distribution channels for unusual music styles?
Yeah, you know, again, I guess, and we're speaking over the internet, I think the internet is that new thing, but even then, you're dealing a real hall of mirrors where... Yeah. You have to be tethered a bit to a computer still to listen to a lot of stuff. You can podcast and put it on your iPhone and transfer it, but I think the guy who's working on a car, the person who's unloading a truck, you know, the radio, you know, terrestrial radio still just kind of finds its way in much more pockets. And
satellite radio somehow did not really make it.
I'll tell you, it's the funny. Biggest thing with that is because you have to buy the thing. Like every grandmother, mother, father, you know, older guy, younger. You know,
but you have to buy a radio, too. I mean,
you need a radio almost for survival. It's in your alarm clock to go and buy just a Sirius. And then you were, oh, should I get the XM one or the Sirius one? It just didn't seem like a winning format. Certainly, I think they believed in it more than they should have. I mean, how much did they give Howard Stern? Like $10
billion? Oh,
That backfired. It was not as successful as I thought it would be.
No, I mean, it kind of took the teeth out of Howard. I mean, I don't follow real pop culture in a deep way that, you know, some people do. But, you know, Howard was Howard, you know, and now since he went into satellite, you just, you know,
he's
people
marginalized.
Can't get him.
Yeah.
He's been marginalized.
Yeah, in some ways, his detractors are quite happy that he's been kind of got this big deal and basically been put under wraps.
Yeah,
you know?
He got the big paycheck, and then he disappeared essentially from the national airwaves.
No,
exactly.
Yeah.
We could have used him during this last summer debate.
No kidding, huh?
Yeah, he would have been a good guy to have on. I used to enjoy Howard Stern when he was, I think, 92.3.
Yeah.
Now tell us, what instrument do you play, and what instrument do you play, first of all?
Well, you know what? In the end, I play a lot, but right now I've always been a bass player, and I started out in the bass player, and it just seemed like the right fit for the type of personality I was heading towards as a very young man.
So
I don't like
high
frequency.
What do you mean by that? How does the instrument fit the personality?
Well, that's a good question. When you start meeting people that play like drummers, you start meeting breeds of people, and I imagine any you know, profession, like say a sound engineer that maybe does radio engineering, you realize a man who takes care of things is not very verbose, ends up being an engineer perhaps, you know. But a bass, I could...
Sorry, Nat.
I could, yeah, exactly. I threw that out to the silent man who's, I'm sure, running the show back.
Well, that's why he's avoided getting the producer mic for 6 weeks, is because he's like, that means people might hear my voice.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the bass is, you get to stand up front. Kind of up front. You could stand by the drummer if you want. But, so you're not sitting at a keyboard looking like you're ironing shirts.
Right.
You're like... You're standing there, but you're not the lead guitar player that has to say, okay, me,
yeah, watch
me, mine.
Yeah.
So,
but wait, in the Beatles, Paul was the bass player.
So that's an exception.
And George, who was the quietest one, was the lead guitarist, right? And John was the rhythm guitar?
Well, see, here's the asterisk next to the job description is, if you sing lead... You get to go up front like Sting or Paul or,
and you
know,
can play whatever.
Yeah, exactly. You're up there like Geddy Lee or something, you know, not the most comely man, but, you know, he's the front man.
Well, so, very interesting. Now, let me ask, when you
Iggy Pop is not beautiful either, but, you know,
he's kind of
got some allure to him.
But, yeah, you know what? Back in the day, he was quite, you know, mercurial rock star. I mean, you see those silver pants, you know, pictures.
It was all about the silver pants and I swear the cod piece. And I saw him in concert. I bet I saw you.
You might have seen me, yes.
Well, way back.
My trajectory to Iggy and a lot of other bands came from basically starting out, learning how to play, playing around, you know, my local areas. And again, without taking this down any particular road, it was a robust scene in the late 70s or early mid 70s, and it was local bands. We're everywhere, and so you really had a lot of choices. Everyone was booking 5-6 nights a week of bands, you know, because the DJ thing wasn't really an issue. People weren't looking for that type of music. So it was a very good time to start. And then I moved to Boston and started joining bands or forming bands and trying to get record deals, and a couple of them worked out. In fact, the first one, I was 20 years old, we got nominated for a Grammy.
Wow, amazing. What record was that?
You know, it was a band called Rubber Rodeo, believe it or not. And it was mostly Rhode Island School of Design people and myself. And
so, did you go to RISD?
I didn't go to RISD. I went to Mass Art, which is up in Boston.
Yeah.
Because as a musician, I was already making money and living as a musician, you know, and I didn't want to go to Berkeley or any of these places and ruin it.
RISD is where the Talking Heads came from.
Exactly. So it's an interesting little... You know, it's not a cheap school, but interesting.
Very interesting people.
So absolutely. After doing record deals and losing record deals and realizing you can't make a lot of money to live on an assigned band even, I threw my lot in, because I was already a studio musician by this point on the side, I just threw my lot in to be a pro kind of, you know, touring guy. And
how does that work? I mean, like, when you know that you're trying out for Sarah McLachlan or, you know, Iggy Pop or something like that, do you change what your style of play to accommodate them, or do you just play your go-to song, or do they already know you before you even come and it's more word of mouth? I mean, how does someone jump around to so many different musical styles and personalities?
You know what? It becomes a word of mouth. And like a lot of businesses, it's really like, we need a guy. Oh, this guy's good. Oh, great.
And he's nice to work with. I bet that plays a lot into it.
Because you're in buses.
And you show up on time,
and
you're at rehearsal, and you're not stoned.
Or maybe you are stoned, but you're at rehearsal.
But you can still play.
Or you share whatever you're using, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Generous with your stash.
Yes, exactly. So,
thank you, Katie, by the way, for your donation earlier.
So it's you know, by the time you get to a certain level, it's kind of a wink and a nod, and everyone's on the same page of behavior. But there are shades within that, you know, and how things work within the dynamic. Because, you know, the other 22 hours of the day, you're kind of in a bus or, you know, kind of packed together. And you got to know how to kind of be yourself and be part of a group at the same time. So
And not get into people's faces.
What was the challenge?
Other musicians will want to be with someone, you know, so they'll recommend you.
Now, tell me, what was the challenge? Was who did you most get along with? Or, you know, I mean, did you and Iggy get along? Or Sarah, like, who were you naturally? I mean, is it a challenge to get along with these people in that type of environment?
Or to adapt to their musical style?
Yeah, or just their personalities and where they'd want to stop and their schedule.
Yeah, you know, it is a weird one because Iggy being... You know, I grew up looking at Hit Parader and Cream and just seeing pictures of this guy. I didn't really even know what he sounded like because he wasn't on the radio. And, you know, I couldn't buy his records at my Sears, you know, record stereo area of Sears back in the day. So I didn't know who he was, but just the pictures alone, it's like, my God, you know, he's crazy. And then I met him when I started playing with him in 1991, and he seemed like just a really nice Midwestern guy.
Yeah.
And then we started working together, and I realized, well... No, he's crazy. He's completely crazy. And, you know, there's a line in the sand that you just... He's on this other side of life. He sold his soul to rock and roll. You know, he really did. And he lives it in a way that's not... You know, it's not a Target ad type of... A Target the store type. You're like, rock and roll, baby, we're all rock stars. It's like, it's in his bone. You know, he did nothing. You know,
it's
he lived
in
on the street.
Piece.
You know, he just... So Sarah's another story. She's Canadian, and by default, Canadian people are just generally nice.
Yeah, and more so mellow. Funny. Yeah.
Yeah, and a very self-effacing collection of people up there. They're very, I don't know, not everybody, obviously, but all the Canadian people, artists I've ever worked with, there's a real, like, you know, down-to-earth quality that's built into their culture. Maybe it's socialized medicine.
Maybe that's probably what it is. God, is that what we can look forward to, everyone being nice?
Wouldn't that be sweet?
Now, I know one of the things you do is you discover new talent and then help produce them. Tell us about some of the more exciting people that you found and what you look for in a young talent.
Well, you know, that's a good question. The first is, you know, there is the talent part. And how they look, how they hold themselves, how what they've been doing already to help themselves, because there's a lot of raw talent, and raw talent sometimes is just that, and that's the end, the beginning and end. And you'd love to help them all, but they've got to really be willing to put in 200% to my 100%, because, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not going to be up there in the front row doing it. They are, and they better say, okay, I'll get in the car and drive 9 hours, you know, do a $50 gig. Mm-hmm. You know, they just got to have that.
So there's
in them,
still that same old-fashioned. I mean, you really do have to put in the face time. You have to play the small audience. You have to be willing to,
and you have to be on. Just like we talked about with Gina, you have to be on 100% of the time. You can't not have a sucky performance one day because you're not feeling it. I mean, if you're expected to be that person, you have to be great.
You really have to put it out, and if you're not feeling great, you got to have a default. And this is where musicians, like pro musicians like myself and others, is that even at your worst day, you get it done, and no one can tell, like, wow, you're off. Mm-hmm. You know, you say, oh, I didn't feel that, but you know what? When you play it back on the recording, or the record, it always sounds fine. And you got to have this level that your worst day is still a cut above everyone else's, mm-hmm. you know.
Best day.
So that's where it's at. You know, having said that, there was a girl that I kind of discovered and nurtured going by the name of Allison Sudol, but she has a band name called A Fine Frenzy, and she has a record out. Actually, her second record just came out, and just number one on iTunes pop charts. But it's pretty amazing. And she was definitely a weird behind closed doors, did a couple of gigs, but didn't really build a following. It was in L.A., and L.A. is a funny one because you can get a lot of people interested very quickly without having to do the circuit, because it is L.A., and there's a lot of executives in the town to just come and watch. And kind of got her signed right out of the gate without doing a ton of shows, and that was very lucky, and the president of the company signed her, so that was...
Was she hot? Did that factor in?
Pretty much, you know.
No,
I guess some things you never get away from. What kind of music does she play?
You know, she does kind of singer songwriter girl music, but with
another one.
Can you believe it? You know,
I mean, like, honestly, they all sound the same to me, man.
You're talking to the preaching to the choir here. Yeah, I get them all coming through my transom. Ooh. You know what? She kind of just differentiated herself with the help of me and a friend of mine of, you know, just much more ethereal, a little more kind of quirky. I mean, they're all quirky now. It's hard to say why she did the business she did. Most of it, like I said, once she didn't do the hard work before she got signed, but once she got signed, she got out there and she toured and toured and toured, and just she's been on the road for two years straight.
A lot of people are like that. You know, when the light is on, they do better. You know, athletes are like that. But we only have a couple more minutes, and we actually had Scott, the pitmaster from Rub Barbecue, on before you, and he's from upstate New York. And wanted to ask, he's from...
Trumansburg,
right next to Ithaca.
Like as in Harry S? I mean,
yeah, I meant to ask him if it was named after the... it had to have been, right?
No, I think it's before that.
Maybe it was his birthplace, and they changed the name. I don't
know
where Harry Truman was born.
Maybe it's just coincidence, guys, you old... Ellen Stoner's, you're like, there must be a connection. I wanted to ask,
maybe a street, not a town, right?
It's possible.
That's quite a consensus.
It is.
Does Woodstock still have, I mean, other than what would happen naturally, the usual percentage of music energy within a place, especially being close to New York, but is there something still that people are attracted to Woodstock because of its history? Do you sense a kind of burgeoning or bubbling kind of magma of creativity there?
Well, that's a good question. I've been here since July.
Okay.
But having said that, I have a new artist that I'm kind of nurturing, and she's hitting the campaign trail pretty hard. She just turned 18, and she was still in high school, and she'd have to get driven down. At that time, I was renting down Westchester.
She's not even legal to drink in most of the bars she plays in.
Exactly. And her name's Lindsay May, with M-A-E. And she's from Saratoga Springs up here.
Cool.
And that one of the reasons I kind of work with her was her talent and her kind of like drive just even in high school. And she was already doing gigs before that, so she'd already been doing a couple of years of gigs. And so, you know, there's talent. It's the Berry Gordy system. Mm-hmm. There's talent everywhere. Berry got all his talent from Detroit. You know, he didn't fly down to Texas and look at some band. He found everyone, those musicians that played on a million hits, some of the finest musicians, everyone references them. Every musician bows down and tries to play like these people. They were all just living in the neighborhood.
Well, I would say I've invented one word, which only my mother uses occasionally. But there's terroir, which is the knowledge of the land, and then there's tetoir, which is kind of the skill sets of a place, you know? And like,
wow.
I wonder if, like, Limoges, for instance, in France, maybe just all the porcelain people kind of flock there after two or three generations of creativity. And I'm sure to this day, Woodstock and Detroit ends up somehow bringing a certain part of people's personalities out because that place is known for it, you know, and talent breeds talent in a way.
I think
so.
That's
it's like
it.
Tetoir, the knowledge of the head, you know, and the hands. So.
Yeah,
that's great. That puts it in perspective. You know, Woodstock is a town. I think a lot of people came here to do music and be involved because it's been an arts community since the turn of the century. Mm-hmm. You know, like more plastic arts, but. You know what? When you're here, you realize why Van Morrison came up here and wrote a record, and Dylan, you know, Dylan was here because Grossman, his manager, was up here. And but there is something to be. It's just far enough away from the city, but it's not so far out. And once you, like you said, you get enough musicians in one place, then more will come.
Yeah, and you guys can all have fun playing together and just hanging out at each other's houses.
Well, Hal, this has been absolutely great. I hope you will come to the studio and play a set here at Roberta's. We have all the equipment, or else just be a semi-regular call-in, because it sounds like we could have talked for the full hour.
I'd love to do a regular call-in about what's happening in the music world. Get an update on, you know, who's hot, who's breaking.
Yeah.
And, you know, at least in the sort of particular music genre or niche that you inhabit.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, well, I inhabit a few, but say smooth jazz, I might be a little fuzzy on, but in general, I...
So you're telling us we need to be listening for Lindsay May,
Lindsay
from
May,
Saratoga
right.
Springs, and
right.
for Allison Sudol of, what is it, a fine Frenzy. I wanted to say Feeding Frenzy, but...
Talk about food!
And a new Iggy Pop record, and just to wrap up really quick here, I played with Iggy, he's a bass player, we got together, blah, 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 and at one point he wanted to do some jazz standards, we did it, and I put it in the bottom drawer, I brought those out this past year, and we finished this jazz record, it's out, it's called Preliminaire.
Ooh, Preliminaire with Iggy Pop.
And he's singing in French, by the way. And,
Too funny.
It's very dark, weird record that a lot of people are very responding to and feeling very much like Iggy's back on his creative, you know.
That's great.
French. Ma,
alors, Al, je vous remercie beaucoup pour cette interview. C'était très intéressant.
Oui, vraiment. Très intéressant.
We're going to order escargot next. All right.
That's right.
Oui, oui. Alors, à bientôt, j'espère. Ça, c'est Heritage Radio Network. Je suis Patrick.
Je suis Catherine.
A tout à l'heure. We will be right back with an obituary about Variety's Army Archard, who just died at 87. Thanks, Hal.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was great.
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by Edwards of Surrey, Virginia. www.edwardsvaham.com.
All right, well, Katie, I'm sorry to do this. I'm just going to do a non sequitur here. I just want to drop the sound effect, which I was looking for an excuse to drop, but couldn't.
Okay, could do it. Out in the jungle. Yeah.
Also, I'm very fascinated by this sound effect, which actually
Look at baby.
I know. This is where Roberta's restaurant. I love this one because it has this crow that comes flying in at the end. Like, this sounds normal, doomsday, but then listen to this, like, frenetic New Yorker one. Did you hear it? He just comes racing in there at the end.
Yes. Well, this crows are an interesting species.
We're going to have talk a about few another on. Time. Actually, what yeah, was that old cartoon? I think they were called like Heckle and Jekyll.
Heckle and Jekyll.
Love
you betcha.
Them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Love McGilla Gorilla, Heckle and Jekyll.
I did not like McGilla Gorilla. He was dumb. Heckle and Jekyll predated
well, how did he
that.
Keep escaping if he was so dumb? You think it was just you're saying the owner, the it pet was one shop of those owner was stupid?
Cartoons that made me cringe. Like the All Three right. Stooges. All anyway, right. We're at the last segment of the Q Report on Heritage Radio Network. Yep,
it's been over an hour and a half of hopefully good tags. We hope that Jack has been listening.
Tagging
and
up a
tagging.
Storm. Yeah, he's nodding an affirmative. Thank you, Jack Inslee, for producing this show. Thank you to Nat Wiener, our engineer for today,
who actually helped tag the producer. The programs page, so
That's
everyone
right.
should go back, and people should start calling in. You know, we would love to get more call-ins, but we have more shows than ever. It's
oh
really amazing.
Oh, my God.
Amazing.
It's amazing. Heritage Radio Network is growing by leaps and bounds. So we're at the last segment of the Q for today.
And it's an obituary.
And, yeah, as it should be.
Variety's Army Archer died at 87.
And he was one of the last and the best of the entertainment columnists that was not a muckraker.
And he did some very interesting things. I mean, yeah, he was not a muckraker in this day where especially these like E! Entertainment news, like, oh my God, help
oh,
some of these
gag
stars
a maggot,
out.
Man. Yeah, please.
This guy was really old, and someone wrote, Army's finest hour was his courageous stand against the blacklist at a time when almost all other Hollywood columnists were red hunting.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's awesome. If I was back in that day, man, I would not have given up any names at all. Which yeah, I'm very, very proud that he didn't. He was the official greeter of the Academy Awards for 47 years. He was also one of the first writers to link AIDS to a celebrity when he wrote a piece detailing, you know, Rock Hudson's treatment. So I think, you know, very interesting person. And someone had a great line, which I wanted to read. There will always be, this is something that J.F. Lawton said from Pretty Woman. He wrote Pretty Woman. With who was in Pretty Woman, the beautiful
Julia Roberts and Richard Gere.
Nice.
And it was fun. My daughter, who's 13, just watched Pretty Woman, and she was like, Mom, I didn't want to tell you I was watching it because I thought you might get all overprotective on me. And I was thinking to myself, you're damn right.
Why? Because you didn't want her to grow up to be a prostitute?
Though I enjoyed the movie, yes, as a role model, I don't want her to think the prostitution is glamorous.
How
or
else
easy.
Is she going to meet a Richard Gere type? So writer J.F. Lawton wrote or said, there will always be three iconic moments in the Hollywood life. Seeing your name for the first time on a movie poster.
Yep.
Seeing it on a billboard.
Yep.
And when you see it for the first time in Army Archer's column. So actually very amazing. Talk about prolific. He wrote a 900-word column on page 2 of Daily Variety's 5 days a week. Until the 1990s, so yeah. For about 30 years.
And then he continued to blog and write on their online site. So
also, like, he kind of came out against, I mean, rest in peace, Charlton Heston, probably not a bad person, but I love how Army came out against
the NRA.
Yeah, you know, you can't be like that anymore. Times change, you know.
That's
sometimes
right.
Your ideas have to change, too. Army stuck true, and I love he used an old typewriter with a manual typewriter.
Beautiful.
Which I found out, you know, to this day, computers have all of their keys. You know, it's still like the A is here, the
yeah,
P is
still
on
laid
the
out
upper
in
right.
That same
and the only
format.
Reason that was laid out and they just stuck with it after all those years is because those old manual typewriters, you needed to spread out the most popular letters so not all the bars would hit the little ink yes. strip at the same time. You know how yeah. they get stuck?
Yes,
so they
I
were
do.
Doing that. That was built off the manual typewriter, I but it has stuck around that, with Macintosh computers.
Thank you.
Yeah, my brain is much more clear this Sunday and will continue to be for the future Sundays.
That's a good thing. Yeah.
So anyway, well, Army.
Rest in peace, rest Army in Archer. Peace. Thank you, for your contributions to the entertainment industry over the years and
yeah.
for keeping high the flag of integrity and compassion.
In journalism, sometimes privacy is important. Well, this has been a great Sunday. Today
great
on the
Sunday.
Main course, we had...
Gina DePalma from Babbo. We had Michael Hurwitz and Liz...
I think
Colorella.
It's just she only has one name.
Okay, but from the Green Market, telling us what's going on there. We had
Scott
Flushing Farm.
Flushing Farm just opened. We had Scott the pitmaster.
We had Scott the pitmaster.
And we had Hal Kirkin talking about music.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Next week we have a huge.
We have a huge
week.
Show.
We have
on
Sally
the main
Fallon,
course.
Head of the Weston Price Foundation, which is one of the more interesting nonprofit educational groups in the country about food, and it promotes eating fats and stuff. Who else?
We have Ann Cooper, the Renegade Lunch Lady, who will be calling in from Denver. She has partnered up with Whole Foods to try to restore wow. nutrition to the school system. This has been a 15-year-plus battle for Ann Cooper,
big.
And she is finally making real headway.
We have Andy Smith, a food historian.
A fantastic food historian who's publicizing his new book, which is coming out from Columbia University Press. It's all about the 30 sort of defining moments in food history of the last century that have contributed to the way we source and eat
well,
nowadays.
The birth of heritage foods better damn well be one of those 30. And then the other thing, Mark Marabella, who will be back with you and me, Katie, next week, is going to be talking about, he has a husband and wife documentary team coming on. So it's going to be
our
most action-packed.
A great show. Two great shows.
I mean,
back to back.
People are going to need to strap themselves into their seats for that one.
That's right.
Well, thanks, guys. We've been sponsored by Sam Edwards. And next
thanks
on Heritage
Roberta's
Radio.
Thanks to Roberta's Pizza for hosting us. And
the
we'll
caffeine
see you on the
stream
street.
In 1 hour.